We hear a lot today. You know, there are various terms used in our culture from time to time, buzzwords or popular, specifically here, psychological terms. From time to time, we hear people talking about having to get closure. When some tragedy takes place, they want closure concerning that event. And I want to mention to the Beeville congregation that the faithful brethren in Northeast Oklahoma are angry with you for taking Brother Patterson away from us. It was a low-down, scoundrel thing to do. And now I feel a lot better. How about you? That was closure. No, we know that he's doing a good work here. And we appreciate that. We appreciate what he did in Northeast Oklahoma. There are not a lot of good, strong, sound congregations and preachers in that area. And so you certainly appreciate those who are. And we hated to see him go. Thank you. I told you I'd do a good job. If you will, go ahead and turn to Matthew chapter 25 this morning. Matthew chapter 25. If you're looking at the outline in the book, we're going to deviate from that just a little bit. I hope to still make some of the same major points and maybe even gather up the majority of the details within that. But I want to approach this lesson today from a slightly different angle, specifically from the parable of the talents. You're familiar with that parable, and you're also familiar with the general context in which it is found. Remember that the parable concerns preparedness. You remember back in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus had made a comment to his disciples about the temple. And he said that after they were talking about how great and wonderful and beautiful the temple was, Jesus proclaimed that a time was coming when not one stone would be left upon another. And that, of course, excited interest in the disciples. And they automatically assumed that Jesus was talking about the end of the world. In their minds, the temple was going to stand throughout time. And so at any time when the temple was destroyed, that must indicate that the world had come to an end. So they wanted to know about the end of the world, about the time when these things of which he had just spoken were going to come to pass. So really they asked about two different events, didn't they? Well, in the following verses and all of Matthew chapter 24, we find that he divides that chapter, really, he divides that discussion into two parts. He talks about the destruction of the temple, and that was going to take place in AD 70 during the destruction of Jerusalem. And he talks about how certain signs were going to precede that great event, that great and terrible event. And he told them to take heed, to watch out, to know that when these signs came that they needed to flee from the city. And certainly we're told from history that they did see those signs and that they were spared. But at the same time, Jesus went on after he finished that discussion to talk about the end of the world. And the end of the world is going to be a little bit different than the end of Jerusalem, because as the end of Jerusalem was preceded with signs, the end of the world is not going to be preceded with signs. And so he makes the point within the parables that follow in the last of chapter 24, and the parables of chapter 25 and the prophecy of the judgment day in chapter 25. He tells them to be ready. You don't know when it's going to take place. Be ready. Well, that's really the general context of the parable of the talents. It's a parable that talks about being prepared, making ourselves ready for the return of the Master. You are familiar with that parable. Well, let's go ahead and notice a few points concerning that parable and notice how it applies to our discussion today about the work of the church. Keep in mind that this is a parable not only about preparedness, but it is a parable about the church. He begins this parable in verse 24 by saying, "For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country." The kingdom of heaven, as we know, is the church. And so he's telling us something about the church. Let's notice from this parable a few points that are very important, especially when we think about our subject this morning. First of all, we notice that the church, or the kingdom, is a realm of trust. It is a realm of trust. The servants under consideration in Matthew 25, 14 and following were stewards. They had been entrusted with the possessions of the master. Now, they did not own those possessions outright. They did not belong to them outright. But they were entrusted with them and were told, obviously, and were trusted to take care of those things and to fulfill certain responsibilities. And by the way, we're not told all of the details about what he wanted them to do, but we know as the parable comes to a close that they were obviously given responsibilities because two of the servants, two of the stewards, were commended and rewarded for their actions, and a third was condemned as a result of his action, or really lack of inactivity. So they were given responsibilities. But let's go to this idea again that the kingdom of Christ, the church of our Lord, is a realm of trust. Stewardship is the idea of being trusted to use well that which belongs to another. If all the calculations are correct, we understand that a talent was a weight of silver, or a block of silver, an amount of silver that could have weighed as much as 75 pounds. And one of these talents was worth about 6,000 days worth of labor. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And so here is this master entrusting his servants, his stewards, with these great amounts of material possessions. And obviously you know what the application is. God has entrusted us with certain things. He has certain works which He wants done. He has certain obligations that He wants met, certain responsibilities which He wants us to meet, He wants us to fulfill. And we have the responsibility then of being good stewards. In 1 Corinthians 4, 2, Paul wrote that it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. Surely we can see the mindset of the individual, the master in the story of Matthew 24, or Matthew 25, 14 and following. Surely he trusted the men. He gave them these great amounts of material possessions. Surely he trusted them to use them wisely. They were worth a lot. And certainly God has given us responsibilities that are very important in nature. And let's talk about those works for just a moment. Specifically, the works of the church. We'll go ahead and mention these and get them before us, and we'll talk a little bit more in detail about them as time goes by. The works of the church are threefold. They are benevolence, evangelism, and edification. Those are the responsibilities that we have. Now, I know that we might sometimes, and I think properly so, say that the major concern of the church is to seek and to save that which is lost. Our major work is evangelism, and the other two works really go hand in hand with that major task. But God has entrusted us with these responsibilities, and we have to ask ourselves, how faithful are we going to be about that? And that's another point, but we'll get into that in a moment. Now, we'll get back to the outline that's in the book, but let's notice another point concerning this parable. We find that the church, or the kingdom under consideration in Matthew 25, is a place that has both law and license. It is a place that has both law and license. God requires us to do certain things. Remember, He has entrusted us with three works: benevolence, evangelism, and edification. He wants those things done. Now, there are other things that He wants done. We talked about worship yesterday. We mentioned the study of the Scriptures, and surely that goes along with the edification and the evangelism. But concerning these works, keep in mind that God has given certain requirements for us. There are laws that we must obey. Again, we don't know all of the rules which were given to these stewards in Matthew 25. We don't know all of the details, but we know that there was at least a certain amount of freedom. We know that they were allowed to go and trade and make more. Now, exactly the details of that trading and that making more, we're not told. And perhaps they weren't even told. They were simply told to do it. That was their specific responsibility. Two of them lived up to their responsibilities and one failed. we have to remember the same thing, that there is law and there is license. And we need to be able to distinguish the two. It is wrong for us to loose where God has bound, and it is wrong for us to bind where God has loosed. Giving an illustration just in this realm of evangelism, what do the Scriptures tell us concerning preaching and teaching the gospel? Go. We think about Mark 16, 15 and 16, or Matthew 28, 18 through 30. We're told to go. To go preach or to go teach. Now, how are we to go? You know, this is as old as the Scriptures. I know that these illustrations have been used before and you're familiar with them. We don't know if, or we're not told in the Scriptures, rather, if we're to go by horseback or by foot, by camel. Certainly the Scriptures don't say anything about going by vehicle, by car, rather, or by truck or by airplanes. Or, well, those are realms of expedience, aren't they? We're simply told to go. As long as we have the right message, and it's important for us to have the right motive behind that message too, there's a certain amount of license as to how we are to go. So again, the kingdom of heaven involves law and license. Also, we notice that the kingdom of heaven, the church of our Lord, is a place where energy and effort, and we might even add enthusiasm, are to abound. The five-talent servant and the two-talent servant were busy. Again, we're told that they traded and made more money. Even though the details are not specified, we know that this took work. Think about the commendation, well done. What you've done is right. There's action involved. Now keep in mind that the one-talent man, he did a little bit of work too, didn't he? He at least went out and dug a hole and buried it, and that's a little bit of work. It wasn't the right kind of work. It wasn't what the master wanted, and it permitted him not to do much of anything. Let me go ahead and make this point concerning evangelism and also defending the truth, and perhaps that falls under this category of exhortation. The Scriptures are clear concerning defending the truth. We think about Philippians 1:17. Paul was set for the defense of the gospel, and so must we be. We could go to Jude 3 and clearly find in that passage that we are to contend and to contend earnestly for the faith. Think about this one talent man for a minute. He buried this talent in the ground. I understand that it was legal if someone were to happen to just come across a treasure in first century culture, it was theirs. Kind of the idea of finders keepers. Isn't there another parable in the Scriptures that deal with that? The man that happened to find the treasure in the field. Finders keepers. It may be the case that this one talent man even protected that which he had buried. Maybe he made sure that no one else was going to dig it up. No one else was going to find it. No one else was going to do anything with it that would harm it in any way. Maybe he protected it. We need to make sure that we not only, though, defend the gospel, that we spread it. He was not using the talent. He was burying it. He was defending it. He was protecting it. That's fine. But at the same time, there was some use that needed to be made of it. We have to do the same thing with the truth. We have to do the same thing with the gospel. We have to spread the message. So I think there's a good lesson in that if we think about it. Well, again, this is a place of energy and effort, a place of enthusiasm. Think about the works that we've mentioned, benevolence and edification and evangelism. Think about the Apostle Paul for a minute. Actually, we could even talk about the Christ and about his attitude in these kinds of areas. What are we told about him? We're told that he was one who went about doing good. When we picture the Christ, we surely picture this man going about constantly engaged in spreading the good news of the kingdom and even warning people of disobeying and of not being prepared. Again, that's Matthew 25. So we think about him evangelizing. We think about him edifying or exhorting, building up. He constantly encouraged individuals, didn't he? Wanting them to do what was right. And again, he constantly went about helping individuals. Now, we know that that was to open the doors to the kingdom, and we'll talk about the benevolent work and aspect in just a moment and what it accomplishes. But Jesus is a good example of someone who put forth effort and energy in these kinds of areas. But the Apostle Paul is another one. Think about the enthusiasm of Paul in benevolence. We think about passages like 1 Corinthians 16 and 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. Here was a man who set this plan in motion to help the churches or the needy saints in Jerusalem. And he went about with that plan in a very busy fashion, in a very energetic way, didn't he? He wanted to help those individuals. At the same time, we know that he was very enthusiastic concerning evangelism. We think about all of those missionary journeys that are recorded for us in the book of Acts concerning Paul. Let's look at the book of Romans for just a moment. I think that we find a good picture of Paul's attitude toward preaching the gospel and evangelism and spreading the news. Now remember that these were already Christians, and so maybe we can put under this the category or classify this as the category of edification. But in verse 14 of chapter 1, he says, I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. I am ready. Paul had a moral sense, or a sense of moral obligation. He was indebted. He had been given the good news. Someone had evangelized him. The good news had been presented to him. Remember that Christ appeared to him on the road to Damascus, and then he was told to go into the city, and there it would be told what he must do. We know that that good man came into that town, and he evangelized. He taught the Apostle Paul what he needed to do in order to be pleasing to God. Paul felt a sense of a moral obligation. He wanted others to be given the same opportunity that he had been given. Remember the idea about burying the talent? We have this wonderful possession that God has given us. We have the gospel. What are we doing with it? Are we burying it? Are we protecting it, and perhaps protecting it to the point of not allowing anyone any kind of access to it? Paul was enthusiastic about the gospel. He wanted others to hear. He wanted others to obey. He wanted others to be saved. He wanted others in heaven. It should be our goal in life to get to heaven and to bring as many people with us as we possibly can. We need to be enthusiastic about that. Also, he was enthusiastic about exhortation, about edification. Look at Acts 20. This was pointed out yesterday. I want to go back to it. Acts 20. In verse 27, Paul says, For I have not shunned to declare unto you the whole counsel of God. Paul wanted these individuals to know the truth. They were ones who had obeyed the truth at his preaching and at the preaching of others, but he wanted to continue to exhort them and edify them. Then in verse 28 he says, Take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers to feed the church of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood. He was telling these individuals to do the very same thing. Exhort, encourage. He wanted them as elders to shepherd the flock. For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them. Therefore, watch and remember that by the space of 3 years I ceased not to warn everyone night and day with tears. He was enthusiastic about edifying, about encouraging, about exhorting, about warning individuals. What about us? What is our take on these kinds of things? Do we really know what our responsibilities are as far as working in the church and the works of the church? Remember that we can talk about this in an individual sense and also as a collective sense. And I know that as we're talking about the work of the church, we're thinking about what we have to do collectively. But remember that all of us have parts individually. You remember what the Hebrews writer says, whoever that man was. You remember what he says in Hebrews chapter 3, and then also in chapter 10 and verse 24, we find him encouraging those brethren to encourage one another. Exhort one another daily, he says in chapter 3. In chapter 10, he says, provoke. There's some provocation that's going on. As a matter of fact, in chapter 3, he warns against the wrong kind of provocation, doesn't he? He goes back to Old Testament Israel and he paints this picture of what those individuals did. He goes actually to Psalm chapter 95 and quotes that, an event probably that was being referred to concerning Exodus chapter 17. But anyway, he says, listen, you remember back then what those individuals did? They provoked God. And they paid the ultimate price as a result of it. Do not do that. Remember the background of the book of Hebrews. These individuals were in danger, in imminent danger of turning back and going back to the old law, leaving Christ and Christianity, forsaking the gospel, and going back under that Old Testament system that had already been done away with. And so he's warning them, listen, those individuals back then apostatized, and you are in danger of doing the same thing now. Exhort one another daily while it is called today. Take advantage of the opportunity to encourage each other. There is strength in numbers, isn't there? We need each other. I'm not saying that someone cannot be faithful by himself. And each of us, as Brother Hayes so eloquently put it last night, are going to have to stand on our own bottom. We're all individually accountable and responsible for our actions. But at the same time, we need to encourage each other because we know that there's strength in numbers. We need one another. And certainly that's one of the great works of the church, to edify, to build up. Paul was enthusiastic about it. Christ was obviously enthusiastic about it. The church is to be enthusiastic about it. We are to put forth effort and energy in doing this. By the way, we can connect this to the last point that we made concerning law and license. The law is edify. Guess what? There are also some laws concerning how we edify. It is not the work of the church. We could make this a point separate in and of itself if we really wanted to. We could talk about what the work of the church is not, couldn't we? It is not the work of the church to come up with fun and games in order to entertain people in such a way that they will keep coming back and bringing more people with them. Listen. We want to evangelize. We want people to come. We want people to heed the invitation of Christ. We want people to heed the invitation of the local congregation and to study the Scriptures. But we do not do that by compromising the truth. It is not the work of the church to come up with fun and games. It's not the work of the church to be just a mere social organism that brings about change in our culture. Now, the gospel is going to do that. Don't get me wrong. When we preach the gospel and people obey the gospel, they change their actions. They change their habits. But you know, there are some that believe that the function of the church is to make society better and we're to be some kind of big social organization and nothing more. We got a call at the office a few days ago by a member of the church. And perhaps she was meaning well. I don't want to question her motives at all. But she works with an organization that is bringing Desmond Tutu to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And she was calling up and she's trying to gather congregations of the Lord's Church to buy tables at this event to hear Desmond Tutu. I don't know much about him, but I'm thinking that he is a social leader, I guess, for social change. But what business is it of the church to pay $1,500 for a table that sits eight people to hear that man? That's not the work of the church. It's not the work of the church to involve itself in those kinds of works. It is not the work of the church to make people feel comfortable in their sins. I don't know if you've picked this up or if you've seen it elsewhere, but there was an excellent article on the Toller's Table out here by Jerry Brewer concerning the liberals' view of Acts chapter 2. If you don't have a copy of it, get it and read it. He points out in that article, basically, you know, tongue in cheek, what would have happened if the liberals, if Peter and the other apostles would have been like modern day liberals. What kind of programs and what kind of ministries would Peter have encouraged these individuals to get involved with, making them feel comfortable in their sins? That's not the work of the church. What do they say? It's the preacher's job to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. There's some truth in that, isn't there? Definitely. We need to make sure that we understand what the role of the local congregation is. Let's go back very quickly and talk about some things still connected with the parable of the talents, at least in a very loose way. I want to mention, and this is really in the outline that you have in the book, concerning this idea of the kingdom or the church being a realm of energy and activity, think about the different descriptions that are used of the church and of Christians individually. This was mentioned really yesterday in a sermon concerning the designations of the church, wasn't it? But you think about some of these different designations. A temple. The church is called a temple in passages like Ephesians 2, 21 and 22 and 1 Peter 2, 5 through 9, where Peter says, "Ye also as lively stones or living stones are built up a spiritual house, an holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ." What do you picture when you think about that Old Testament temple? And especially when you think of the perspective from which we are coming this morning, talking about the kingdom being a realm of activity and effort and energy and enthusiasm. The kingdom, or the temple rather, in the Old Testament was a place of a lot of activities, wasn't it? Constantly busy with all of the prayers and all of the sacrifices, all of the offerings and the gifts that were made. Guess what? That's a picture of the church, isn't it? We are to be busy. We are to be busy. Spending energy, working for the cause of Christ. I think about the designation kingdom. We've mentioned it already a number of times within our lesson this morning. We go to Matthew 16, 18. Jesus was talking about the kingdom and the church in that text, 16 through 18 really. He uses the term church and kingdom interchangeably. We go to Colossians 1, 13 and we find that we have been translated into the kingdom of God's dear Son. We're studying or at least making mention of, in a very loose way, a parable that talks about the kingdom of heaven. A kingdom is usually a very busy place, even if you're thinking just about those official roles. I know that you've heard some of these, but I've heard some interviews with President Bush, and he's been asked about all of the criticism that has been coming his way from his potential competitor in the 2004 elections, and I think that he made a comment once or twice about, "I really don't have time to listen to those things. We're busy. We've got work to do." Think about the kingdoms then of this world. The nations, they're busy. There are things in which they must engage in order to promote their particular kingdoms, in order to promote peace, in order to promote truth and justice, in order to help people who are in need. They're busy. It's a realm of activity. And certainly there are other descriptions of vineyard in Matthew 20, 14, and also verses 7 and 8 of that same chapter. It's a place of activity, a place of laboring. And again, not only just the kingdom as a whole, when we think about the various descriptions of Christians, we go to passages like Colossians 4:11 and Philippians 4:3 and Philemon 24, and we find this term, fellow workers. Fellow workers in the vineyard, fellow workers in the kingdom, fellow workers in this spiritual house. And we go to Romans. You remember that Paul, oftentimes when he was closing a book, he would commend certain brethren and send greetings to certain brethren. I would encourage you sometimes to look at Romans 16:12, where he talks about certain women there who were laborers, and one who labored even more maybe than the others. Labor, what do you think about? I think about blood, sweat, toil, calluses, blisters. That's the kingdom of our Lord. That's the vineyard. We are to be laborers. We are to be fellow workers. There's work to do. Also, the scriptures describe Christians as athletes. 1 Corinthians 9:24 through 27, 2 Timothy 4:7, Hebrews 12:1. These passages talk about running a race and finishing the course. I'm not much of an athlete. But I've seen people who are, and it looks like they sweat quite a bit. It looks like maybe from time to time their muscles ache, they're sore from all of their rigorous activities. And wasn't it the athlete that came up with the expression, no pain, no gain? I'm not interested in gain, physically speaking, because I don't like pain. But spiritually speaking, we ought to be wearing ourselves out in the Christian race. Also, we think about soldiers. 1 Timothy 6:12, 2 Timothy 2, 3, and 4 describes Christians as soldiers. Paul told Timothy to fight the good fight of faith and to endure hardships as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. I was talking to Brother Ricky yesterday. One of his sons is going through boot camp right now. And he said that he made mention, had he known that he was going to have to go through some of those things that he's going through, he probably would not be there, or he doesn't know if he would go through it again. There is activity, energy, toil, labor, a lot of energy and effort. Those are all descriptions of the kingdom of Christ. So how are we to approach the various works in which we are to engage? We are to approach them enthusiastically and energetically. Now, let's talk a little bit more about these specific areas. Benevolence. We can look at Acts 11, 27 through 30, where the disciples were going to send relief to the churches of Judea. We could look again at passages in 1 Corinthians 16 and also 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. And we think about the collection that was being made for the poor saints at Jerusalem. And I would also encourage you, actually, let's look at two passages. Let's go ahead and open your Bibles to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Hold your finger there and go over to Galatians chapter 6. I'm not going to go into details this morning concerning this. But I would encourage you to look and to study Galatians chapter 6 alongside 2 Corinthians 8 and 2 Corinthians 9. It very well may be that Galatians 6 in its entirety is talking about the benevolent aspect of the church and this collection that was being made for Christians and non-Christians. And that's what I want to talk about for just a moment. Ephesians 6 is not the right book, by the way. Now, Galatians 6 and verse 10, Paul says, "As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith." There are those that proclaim that the Christian or that the local church has no scriptural authority to help those who are non-Christians. And they would tell us from time to time, well, every time, that Galatians 6 is not talking to the congregation, but rather he's talking to individuals. Well, let's go to 2 Corinthians now, chapter 9 and verse 13. We'll back up actually to verse 12. He writes, "For the administration of this service," what service? He's talking about this collection that's being made. "For the administration of this service not only supplieth the want of the saints, but is abundant also by many thanksgivings unto God, whilst by the experiment of this ministration they glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ, and for your liberal distribution unto them." Who are them? Those are the Christians. "And unto all men." This word translated all men, and you'll notice that men is in italics, and so there's the question of, well, was he talking about them being the church at Jerusalem and all being all of the churches of Judea, and so all men is not really what's under consideration here, but still just the saints? I would encourage you again to look at 2 Corinthians 9:13 side by side with Galatians 6:10. And I think that you'll find that they are very parallel. Both of them talk about doing good to the saints, and both of them talk about doing good unto all. It seems to me that there can be a very strong argument made that all of Galatians 6 is talking about this collection that Paul was engaged in. When it comes to the area of benevolence, we must be engaged in it. And let me mention one other thing concerning it. Benevolence is a uniting work, it is an uplifting work, and it is an unlocking work. There are 3 points, and if you want to make a sermon out of that, you can. But it is a uniting work. If we were to go to Romans 15, and I feel bad because Brother Hayes said last night that we ought to read those passages instead of just pointing you to them, but we don't have time. See, he even said that was bad, but he's already told me 5 minutes, and that was probably 10 minutes ago. Anyway, if you were to go to Romans 15 and read verses 25 through 31, you would find that one of the reasons behind, and I think that 2 Corinthians passage mentioned the same thing, really, one of the reasons behind Paul pushing this benevolent campaign, we might call it, among the Gentile congregations was to unite the Gentile congregations with those of Jewish origin. He was wanting to unite the Gentiles and the Jews. He was wanting to point out that they could work together and that they were in the same cause and that they were looking for the same thing. And he even stated that this was a way in which the Gentiles could show their appreciation for the Jews. And everything that they had done in spreading the gospel, spreading the good news and being a part of the gospels, even we talked about the scheme of redemption yesterday. And this was a way that they could demonstrate their appreciation for that. Remember also in Galatians chapter 6, he talks about reaping and sowing and there being the recipients of spiritual things. And there, obviously, in turn, it being scriptural to provide physical things to those who had provided them spiritual things. See, Galatians 6 sounds a lot like one of those collection passages, doesn't it? Anyway, it's a uniting work. It's an uplifting work. It demonstrates concern. Remember again that Jesus went about doing good when he did these benevolent type acts, when he helped people physically. It was encouraging. It uplifted them, and that connects with this third little point that we talked about. It's an unlocking work. It opens the doors of opportunity. Someone has said that a person doesn't care how much you know until he knows how much you care. Benevolence allows us that opportunity to demonstrate our care and concern for the spiritual well-being of individuals when they see how much we care about their physical necessities. We could go on, I know, and talk about these other works. Remember, the three areas of the work of the church: benevolence, evangelism, and edification. A final point that we could make concerning the parable of the talents, we don't have time to detail it, but keep this in mind. The kingdom of Christ is a realm of accountability. The master returned, and he returned in order to reward or punish. And it was based upon actions or inactivity. We have responsibilities. We are stewards. How are we using our opportunities? Let us engage faithfully